Prepare to be astonished.
It's that time again.
Let's get started.
From the Clatsop County Historical Society, an adventure in history with Matt Burns and Alana Quila.
You should never be allowed to talk to people.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
And now, with today's adventure, it's Mac and Alana.
Good evening and welcome back to an adventure in history. We're so happy to have you here with us this evening, or if you're listening to a podcast, we love our podcast fans. If you're binge watching or binge listening, I mean, to those podcasts, we're even happier if you're scrolling through.
Do you think people binge listen?
They do. So a lot of the people, at least like my friends or our guests, will do it. So I'll send them the link to our podcast. And they'll get started, like, I'll say, go find the one that you want to listen to. Like look for the person that's interesting. And then they just keep it playing.
Oh, how funny.
So they listen to the next one. And the next one, they're, I mean.
It's a lot of Mac and Alana.
It is. But we have some great topics, right? And guests.
Although, I guess when there's guests, it's not so much Mac and Alana.
Right. I do have one listener that has told me he only likes it when we have a guest. I'm like, that person will go unnamed.
I respect that person.
Yes.
You two are not as entertaining.
More guests, please.
Well, they're going to be disappointed tonight.
I know. I'm sorry. Just us,
folks. You should have mentioned that like when we have a guest.
And this is when we get out all of our banter because we don't always get to, because then people just stare at us when we're doing it.
Although technically speaking, we kind of have a guest.
We do have a guest. That's true. Did you want to say hi real fast?
Of course she does.
Hi.
Who is this?
Carly Quia.
I think we're gonna have her as like our mascot. She's gonna be here every week.
Yeah. Well, this is the last. Maybe. Oh no. Well, yeah. Okay. She often comes. So you are in school. So tell us your teacher's name and what grade you're. Or actually, you know what? Maybe we won't do that. Maybe I don't want to share that with the listening world.
Yeah.
But Carly does love school, and
she loves our food exhibit. Feeding the World exhibit.
What do you like about that exhibit? Because this is an exhibit.
You were just out checking it out at the Heritage Museum, the food exhibit.
I like it that it's real food.
That's because our curator went crazy and just shellacked food.
So you can touch it.
You can touch it, but it's real food, but it's shellacked, so it doesn't really move.
But lots of hands-on exhibits, which I feel like maybe the thought was for kids, but you know who I've always seen doing it? As adults.
Oh, yeah.
Every time I peek in there, the adults are doing all of the hands-on stuff. So.
And for local, fun fact, where's Waldo? Skip Hauke's in the exhibit.
I loved that. Yes.
We have recordings of Skip Hauke.
I know. On an old-fashioned telephone. So you pick up the telephone and you get to listen to Skip's voice.
You can place your order.
That was a great idea. Yes.
Yeah. All right. Shall we get right to it?
Yes. Well, I have a word.
Oh, that's right. You have
right?
A word.
This is a lost word. So bringing these back.
Vintage slang. And I don't have anybody to help me now.
This one I think you're just going to get.
Okay.
I think. Ninny hammer.
Mini hammer.
Ninny.
Ninny hammer.
Yep. One word. Ninny hammer.
And hammer like a hammer is the way it's spelled.
Correct.
That's what I'm asking. Ninny. And spell ninny.
N-I-N-N-Y.
Okay, so it's got to be a somebody who thinks they're a carpenter, but is really bad.
It's pretty close. A fool. You ninny hammer.
Oh, see, ninny would just work by itself. I wonder why they add the hammer to that.
I don't know. Yep.
And it's ninny hammer.
Yeah, the picture in the book, which you can't see, is a man blowing a bubble.
Well, that just doesn't seem nice.
You ninny hammer.
You ninny hammer.
I think
that's a ninny, but worse than a ninny.
Yeah. Well,
I like that.
If you're going to insult somebody, honestly, it seems nicer to use words like that than to say you're a fool.
I can't remember if it was like on Netflix or Apple or something, but did you see the Will Ferrell Scrooged?
No.
Christmas special? No. It's a Christmas movie, not a Christmas special.
Right.
But we'll give you the whole gist of it, but there's one point where they're back in time into the 1700s in England, and somebody says, good afternoon. And they get really upset, and the other guy doesn't. He's modern. He doesn't really understand. He's like, why did that guy get all upset at good afternoon? And he goes, oh, that's like the worst curse possible.
Oh, interesting.
And then they have a whole song because it's a musical. about good afternoon, good afternoon. And it's basically saying something really bad to somebody.
Oh, how funny.
And that's what just made me think of.
Yeah.
Ninny Hammer. Like you'd never yeah. think that was really like, horrible or mean.
That does sound like something that would come out of Will Ferrell's mouth.
Yes. It, yeah. it's actually not an Oregon film, but I still recommend it.
Yeah.
It was entertaining.
Good to know.
All right. Shall we get right to it? September 11th. These are things that happen tomorrow. September 11th.
Oh, yes.
Big and day. We probably all know where this one's going.
Yes.
There's certain dates that just are forever now mm-hmm. imprinted, but I won't start with that one. I'm going to start with September 11th, 1777, the Battle of Brandywine.
Ooh.
General Sir William Howe and General Charles Cornwallis launch a full-scale British attack on General George Washington and the Patriot outpost at Brandywine Creek near Chad's Ford in Delaware County, Pennsylvania.
Hmm.
On the road linking Baltimore and Philadelphia, Howe and Cornwallis split their 18,000 British troops into two separate divisions, with Howe leading an attack from the front and Cornwallis circling around and attacking from the right flank.
Ooh.
The morning had provided the British troops with cover from a dense fog, so Washington was unaware the British had split into two divisions and was caught off guard by the oncoming British assault. Although the Americans were able to slow the advancing British, they were soon faced with the possibility of being surrounded, surprised and outnumbered by the 18,000 British troops to his 11,000 Continentals. Washington ordered his men to abandon their posts and retreat. Defeated, the Continental Army marched north and camped at Germantown, Pennsylvania. The British abandoned their pursuit of the Continentals and instead began the British occupation of Philadelphia. Congress, which had been meeting in Philadelphia, fled first to Lancaster, then to York, Pennsylvania, then the British took control of the city without Patriot opposition. The one-day battle at Brandywine cost the Americans more than 1,100 men killed or captured, while the British lost approximately 600 men killed or captured. To make matters worse, the Patriots were also forced to abandon most of their cannon to the British victors after their artillery horses fell in battle. So this backs up once again.
Yeah.
He just didn't lose. That's the big thing, that he doesn't get outflanked and captured and surrender everybody. He manages to get the heck out of there, even though it's a loss.
With the majority.
With the majority.
Huge loss.
But... General George Washington.
Yeah.
Not brilliant, but just didn't lose. Was smart enough not to lose. And that's all we had to do to win the American Revolution.
Yeah.
Wow. So, 1789. Alexander Hamilton appointed the first Secretary of the U.S. Treasury.
Oh, okay.
Now, you like the musical Hamilton.
Of course.
Of course, you say.
Yes.
But you know I've never watched it.
Dancing, never singing.
Okay. We may talk more about this. 1941, construction of the Pentagon begins in Virginia.
Oh, okay. That's later than I would have thought, actually.
41, yeah.
I mean, it makes sense, the timing.
But. And the guy in charge is General Leslie Groves.
Okay.
Which... if people are watching Barbie the movie and Oppenheimer the movie, they know General Groves. Well, only if they're watching Oppenheimer. He has nothing to do with Barbie.
I was going to say, we saw Barbie and there was no...
General Groves is the guy, that, the military guy that runs the Manhattan Project with Oppenheimer that creates the bomb.
Yep.
But first, he builds the Pentagon.
There we go. Interesting.
1959, Congress passes a bill authorizing food stamps for poor Americans.
That's great.
I was thinking about that being the history highlight of the day.
Yeah. 59, too.
59.
See, that's later than I would have assumed as well. I guess I would have thought that was 40s.
I would have thought New Deal
or
stuff.
Or 30s,
the
right.
30s. Yeah.
Yeah.
1971, Nikita Khrushchev dies.
Oh, okay.
I don't know why. I'm amused at the we'll bury you and the stomping of the pulling off the shoe and slapping it on like a gavel on the table. It just makes me laugh. All right. 1977. This, too, I thought about being the history highlight of the day. See, you're not old enough, but I am. The Atari 2600, originally known as the Atari Video Computer System, is released in North America, revolutionizing the video game industry.
Yeah.
This
71.
Was it. 77.
77.
This was it.
Yeah, just barely.
I didn't have one till like 82, 83, 84, somewhere in that range. And all my friends had already had one, and I kind of had to beg my parents.
Oh, my goodness.
And they thought it was stupid and ridiculous, and then they finally relented and got me one.
Yeah. We never had video games in my home. And, I wonder what kids now, if any of them ever go back and play games like that and what they think. Because they're not even similar anymore.
I was going to say, it's totally a different language. Because you got the joystick and a button, and that's it. And that's what I never liked about again, my age, the Nintendo, there's multiple the handheld thing, buttons, and other things you got to push. And I just like the joystick and one button.
Well, and now there's virtual reality. What is Carly, what do you think about virtual reality?
It looks like you're actually there.
And did you like it or not?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. She loved it. And it's very disorienting. I mean, yeah, so that's interesting. Well, yeah, that was the start.
For that, because my son got an Oculus, I think is the name of it.
Yep.
And every time I walk past, when anybody in my family is like doing it and stand there in the middle of the room, I just go, "You idiot," and keep walking. And they all go, "Fair enough."
Yeah.
But they finally got me because one of the programs you can tour Anne Frank's hideout.
Oh, interesting.
The actual museum that's open now, you can tour that. And it really is pretty cool, I have to admit.
Interesting.
I'm not somebody that has continued to use it and played like Jedi games or anything like that. But I have to admit, putting the stuff on and being able to look over and there's something on the table, a book, and I can flip it open, it's pretty cool.
I haven't even thought about that and what that will do, too, for access to that sort of information for people, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you don't have to have the money or the transportation to be able to go to that museum.
Yeah,
you do have to be able to afford to buy that. But, I mean, maybe that, too, will become more or easier to
Our world's changing.
Interesting.
It's scary.
All right.
It's frightening and scary. But our history highlight of the day, the thing I think had the most impact, of course, 2001, the terrorist attacks on the U.S. and the Twin Towers fall. So I think we've actually done a show on September 11th or the day before, and we've discussed this, but you were in Florida.
Yep. I was at the University of Miami in college, and I was a resident assistant and surrounded by tons of students from New York. It was a very small campus, about 1,200 kids on campus, plus professors. And tragically, one of the young women who was on my floor lost her father that day. And then, of course, I ended up knowing quite a few others that just either knew someone who passed away or was killed or was directly affected. So yeah, it was tragic, and it felt very close even though we were in Miami. That was one thing that I noticed when I visited with my friends from Oregon, because Oregon was several hours later, right? Just the different time zone.
And it's like 8 a.m. in the morning. And so really here, that, 5 right. in the morning.
And yes, of course we have connections to New York. Of course we do. But it just felt so all-encompassing in Florida because so many people are direct transplants. So yeah, it definitely left an impact on everyone, right, who was alive.
Florida is New York City South, you know.
It is, I know. So,
or South New York.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were in Vermont. Mm-hmm. I was running the Ethan Allen Museum there, and my wife's mother worked just a few doors down from the World Trade Center, and I'd actually gotten to work and saw we got word of the first plane, and I was like, I better go home. And when I got home, the second plane had already hit the World Trade Center, and my wife was trying to call her mom and couldn't get a hold of her.
Of course, right.
Yeah, and of course, that was, you know, oh my gosh, was she there? Yeah. Was she close? And the cell phones weren't working, and she had to walk to Queens across one of the bridges.
I mean, we saw those pictures, right? I mean,
yeah, and we didn't get a contact from her, I think, till late in the day or late in the evening even. So we didn't really know for sure. And of course, you know, being a kid from New York, I certainly had people in New York City. So, it was a strange thing that, you know, you just wonder. I mean, is it our generation's JFK? But you weren't watching that live,
right? Yeah,
you know, you're getting reports later in the day, and you're getting Walter Cronkite that's saying something's happened versus something's happened, and the cameras are recording the rest of it live for you to watch as
and
it's going.
Person in power versus you and me, right?
Yeah.
Like those were just regular people. One little side note that is interesting and we should go into one day, but my parents actually lived in Florida at the same time. They lived in Hollywood, Florida, so it was a little ways away from Miami. Again, this is connected. So my mom and my brother would often go to the local library, which was just down the street from their home. They'd ride their bikes there, you know, so it was a very, very routine activity for them all year long. Well, that same library, we later learned, was the hub for two of the terrorists.
Oh, wow.
They actually lived and worked out of Hollywood, Florida, and they went to a restaurant, like an oyster bar that was in downtown Hollywood that we all knew. It was a nice place on the corner. And they went to that library often. And this was a tiny library, very tiny, probably the size of the film museum.
Wow.
So you think about that, and you think about how, because they knew how frequently they were there, because they were there using real names and real, you know, real IDs and having access to the internet right there to connect themselves with others, which later became public record and public information. Mm. So you just think about that too. I mean, here are these people that are just like, they're living
amongst us.
Among us. Yeah. Truly.
Yeah. And they're using the library just like anybody else, although, you know, for like, something
and,
really horrible.
And to be able to, you know, look at the people around you and think, these are the same people that we're going to do something to. So.
And that just breeds the mistrust, because you know these people were there, and if you happen to be in the library that day, they probably said hello, and you said hello, and think nothing of it. And now all of a sudden you're distrusting everybody.
Yep. So, yeah, there's, you know, to your point, there's always a Florida connection, right? That was the Florida connection to that one.
There is always a Florida connection. All right. So Alexander Hamilton.
Yes.
Yeah. On this day, we said he was appointed the first Department of Treasury.
Mm-hmm.
So we thought we'd talk a little bit about Alexander Hamilton, because I remember that you were shocked that I had not embraced the musical.
And the sort of out of context delivering of the message.
Yeah. And you like the musical.
I do. Yeah. So. I think that entertainment provides access to information that doesn't have to be accurate, right?
So my question for you is, as we go through this, how much of this did you learn from the musical?
Oh.
Or did you not learn from the musical? So how much of the story did they actually tell? So this is actually by a great article by a person named Sotera Janda. But before 2015, it was common to hear that Alexander Hamilton was by far the most undervalued of all the American founding fathers. But with the explosive popularity of the Broadway musical Hamilton, that statement is no longer accurate. Hamilton fever has swept America, including Alana's household, and he became one of the most popular founding fathers as fans of the musical flocked to historic sites and bought out shelves of books associated with him. Hamilton was not just important in the founding of America, he was also a fascinating historical figure and tireless public servant. Though it's easy to sing Hamilton's praises today, it is also worth noting that he was highly controversial and divisive in his own time. Sure. Hamilton was a man who inspired admiration and respect just as fiercely as he inspired outrage and offense.
Indeed, a portrait can be drawn of Hamilton as a brash and renegade founding father who was passionate about his ideals and vision for what the new American nation could become. These Alexander Hamilton fun facts reveal a brilliant, singular man in an age of great men. Though never elected as U.S. president, Hamilton's shadow looms large. Considering all of the amazing things Alexander Hamilton did in his relatively short timeline, his legacy deserves to be remembered.
Okay, so is that still in tune with the musical?
Sure, yep.
Okay, so one of the fun facts, he dropped out of college to join the revolution. Hamilton journeyed to the mainland to get an education. In the 1770s, colonial America had a handful of options for young men to undertake courses of study. Though Hamilton hoped to attend Princeton, that institution rejected his proposal to undertake an accelerated course of study.
Go ahead.
So by 1775, Hamilton was enrolled at King's College. Today it's known as Columbia University in Manhattan. He was a gifted student with an appetite and aptitude for learning as much as he possibly could. But his interests weren't just academic. The 20-year-old Hamilton was so swept up in the winds of revolution that he dropped out of school and formed his own militia of 25 men. Though clearly a man of words, Hamilton sought to prove that he was a man of action as well. I'm always stunned at 20 years old.
Yeah.
You're 20, and you're jumping in on this revolution and getting people on board and blah, blah, blah.
Yes. Although it makes sense, too, because it's of that age where you think you do know everything,
right?
And probably even more so with the age limits at that time. He was a self-made man. It would be an understatement to say that Hamilton's childhood in the Caribbean was less than ideal. When he was 9, his father abandoned the small family. His mother died of illness a few years later. He refused to let himself and his future be defined by his circumstances. So he became a self-educated and distinguished himself while working in a local import-export office.
He's an importer-exporter. But it doesn't say what he was importing and exporting.
Right.
So I'm curious if they're sweeping something under the rug here.
Right.
Nefarious.
Isn't that usually what that is?
Yeah.
So before he was 30, he founded a bank that existed for over two centuries. There's a good reason that Alexander Hamilton graces the $10 bill. He was a brilliant financial mind whose fiscal policies helped strengthen a burgeoning young nation. But Hamilton was not just interested in the fiscal policies of the American government as a whole. In 1784, Hamilton, not yet 30, founded the Bank of New York, which remained in business until 2007.
Okay, 30, and he's starting a bank.
Yeah.
That, well, too blows my mind.
And that's impressive, too, that it lasted until 2007.
Yeah, right? It was a successful bank.
Yes.
I'm always, yeah, I think like things like that. Is this like the IT of the time period?
Right.
Where people of any background are just starting these things that end up being here forever?
Right.
I don't know. It's just very amazing to me. He was killed in a duel. I think we all know that.
Yes.
There's perhaps no greater evidence of Hamilton's, shall we say,
showmanship
and machismo.
Yes.
If that's a good word. I don't know. That the fact that he died in a duel at the hands of Vice President Aaron Burr. Burr was frustrated with Hamilton, especially after Hamilton repeatedly attacked Burr's abilities and honor. Mm. Burr demanded satisfaction. Though dueling was a fixture of life at the turn of the 19th century, both in America and abroad, it nonetheless was a risky business. Hamilton knew this all too well. In 1801, his eldest son, Philip, had perished in a duel.
Uh-oh.
I didn't realize that.
No.
But that didn't stop Hamilton from meeting Aaron Burr on the dueling ground on the morning of July 11th, 1804, in Weehawken, New Jersey. I have to admit, as much as I like to pick on New Jersey, I do like saying Weehawken. Burr shot Hamilton in the stomach, and Hamilton's death was probably agonizing. Mm. He died 31 long hours after the duel.
All that time to think about, why did I do this?
Yeah, no kidding.
Why couldn't I have just gone back to the bank to work? Hamilton single-handedly authored more than half of the 85 Federalist Papers. In 1787, Hamilton set out to defend the new U.S. Constitution. His method? The pen, of course. He invited John Jay and James Madison to join him in the endeavor. When all was said and done, the team had produced a grand total of 85 Federalist Papers. Of the 85, Hamilton wrote an astonishing 51 under the pseudonym Publius.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, he was involved in America's first sex scandal.
Oh, should I have taken this one?
No, that's okay. Though Alexander Hamilton was happily married to a daughter from a prominent New York family, he strayed from his marriage in 1791 when he began an affair with 23-year-old Maria Reynolds. Reynolds was a married woman, and her husband quickly turned the affair to his advantage by blackmailing Hamilton. As if cheating on his wife wasn't bad enough, Hamilton went on to publicly admit to the affair by publishing a full confession. The affair put a strain on his marriage. Duh. Because, of course, it did, you know. In this instance, Hamilton was that same person in the sense that his conduct was bad, and he was not nice for having the affair in the first place. Maria Reynolds sued her husband for divorce in 1793 and used Aaron Burr, Hamilton's future murderer, as her lawyer.
Wow, we're all in bed with each other.
Yes.
What a small world this appears to be.
I think it's interesting. I, you know, published a full confession.
See, that's his, I'm not going to give in to blackmail.
Right.
So you know what? Here it is.
Yes.
Here,
but it's also
is.
Such
so
a...
now you got nothing on
like
me.
Like a... I just... generally speaking, such a man thing to do. So I'm going to publish all these sort of details and, you know, aside from her.
There's an arrogance about it.
Yes, there is.
But at the same time, I do kind of get the...
Yeah, I'm, can't blackmail
I'm
him.
Taking it out of your hands. So now what do you got?
Right.
So he worked with Aaron Burr to defend a man in the first murder trial in America. The first murder trial.
Ooh.
In 1800, Hamilton became part of the defense for 24-year-old Levi Weeks, a carpenter from New York City. Weeks had been accused of murdering Elma Sands and putting her corpse into a well. The defense team won, largely because the state's case against Weeks was weak and based on circumstantial evidence. Mm. Hamilton was not the only member of Weeks' legal defense, Aaron Burr.
Oh.
The man who'd ultimately take Hamilton's life in the infamous duel at Weehawken was also on the team. So Hamilton and Aaron Burr, ironically, worked together to acquit a man accused of murder.
I feel like all this just ironic. Further proves, though, that Aaron Burr was... did not like him.
No, definitely not.
Didn't like working with him. Didn't like what he did to his wife. Yeah. He was born out of wedlock. Hamilton had the distinction of being the only founding father who was not born in the mainland North American colonies. Instead, he was born in Nevis, a tiny island in the British West Indies. As a Caribbean island, Nevis attracted many young British men seeking to find riches in the empire. One such man was James Hamilton, a younger son of the Scottish laird who traveled there to make his fortune. There he met Rachel Fawcett, a woman who was estranged from her husband. The two lived and had two sons together, though they never married.
Ooh. Hamilton was likely against slavery. Alexander Hamilton grew up in the Caribbean, which was the center of British slavery. There, he probably witnessed the gross inhumanity that defined the system. In 1785, Hamilton joined the New York Manumission Society, an organization dedicated to gradually ending slavery. Mm. Moreover, biographer Ron Chernow characterizes Hamilton as a fervent abolitionist. At the same time, however, Hamilton's attitudes toward slavery, like many of the founding fathers, was inconsistent. Indeed, the family of Hamilton's wife owned slaves in New York. Things were murky, to say the least.
Right. So historians don't actually know when he was born. Alexander Hamilton was definitely born on January 11th, but historians don't know the exact year of his birth. Official documents list 1755 as the year of his birth, though Hamilton often claimed he was actually born in 1757. Whether this was a simple case of mistaken dates or a more purposeful alteration of the facts remain unknown. No matter how you frame it, however, he definitely died before he was 50.
Before he's 50? How young? Jeez. Hamilton's feud with Thomas Jefferson, Thomas J., as I like to call him, helped establish American political parties. Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson were two intellectual pillars in the early years of America, but that doesn't mean they were always got along. In fact, they rarely did. In the high-stakes politics of the young nation, politicians quickly grouped behind either Hamilton or Jefferson. Hamilton and his followers were known as the Federalist Party, which historians now credit as one of the first American political parties. Hmm. And it's always kind of, that's why Washington has Thomas Jefferson on one side and Hamilton over here, and he's getting advice from both that are usually not in line with each other.
Right. Sounds about right. And things haven't changed. He founded a newspaper that still runs. Though Alexander Hamilton is best known for his engineering of the American financial system, he was also a prolific writer. So it should come as no surprise that Hamilton also founded a newspaper. He established the New York Post in 1801, and the paper continues to run to this day. Newspapers in his day were extremely partisan, however, so it's likely that he founded the paper to be a publishing machine for his Federalist Party. Still an impressive accomplishment.
And I wonder how you feel about the New York Post.
Right? I know. So not the same, right? But still very popular. And it does make sense to use those newspaper systems when they originally started for propaganda.
Oh, sure.
I mean, it does make sense.
I'm always a little amazed at people that, well, the newspaper said this.
Right.
Well, newspapers have historically, from the beginning, had a political bent.
Yes.
So
and they were often, I mean, originally they were owned, they had such small ownership too, right? Mm-hmm. So the owner really did have a big influence on what went in or not in the paper. And that can still exist today. And we see lots of newspapers getting bought up, which I hate to see as a former mm-hmm. journalist, because it is nice to have multiple outlets. When I see one newspaper in our community, it makes me miss another competitive source of information. So
from what we just said in 30 seconds, how accurate is the musical?
Oh, it's accurate enough for a fictional based on a true story. And I think it really was able to reach the generation younger than myself and got them interested in history from a different perspective.
It's always a good thing. And did it capture his essence?
Oh, yes. Yes,
see,
I think so.
I'm okay with a little bit of liberty if it's still getting across this guy was
I think
this
very much so, especially because of the music, right?
Yeah. All right. Go make some history. We'll catch you next week. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for joining us for An Adventure in History. An Adventure in History is created and produced by the Clatsop County Historical Society and brought to you by KMUN.